Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Wealth DNA with Ron the Ronald Naraki. It's time to check your wealth DNA so you can enjoy the second half of life. Here's the host of the show, Ron Naraki.
Hello, world. Welcome to the Wealth DNA radio show. It's October 25th. We're broadcasting here from the cozy Boomer and Babe studios in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm Ron Naraki, your host of the Wealth DNA show. Some people call me, especially my investors, call me the Ronald. We're on the air the fourth Monday of every month, and hopefully we'll be hearing from you often during those shows. In a few minutes, our special guest, H.L. Buster Quist, will be joining us. He's an author, historian, expert on economic cycles. He's also the person that, for the last 3 years, I've been going to provide me insights about the global economy, the economic trends, and what asset classes will benefit. I only wish I knew him 10 years ago. Today we'll be talking about the economy, upcoming elections, and earning money, one of the favorite topics on this show. And remember, if you'd like to ask a question, there is a green chat button on your internet screen, and you can also ask that question on the air. Just call in. That number is 917-388-4162. Let me repeat that. That call-in number is 917-388-4162. And, of course, you can listen in if you're driving and hopefully doing it safely. You can listen in through that number as well. When you call in, our producer will get your info, we'll introduce you, and we'll probably remind you to turn down your speakers if you also have your computer on so we don't get some feedback. I made a decision about a decade ago that I would use the wealth I build during my lifetime in an unusual way. Instead of giving $1 million or $2 million or even $5 million to help the poor, that quite frankly wouldn't make much difference. There would still be billions of poor people in the world. But if I can help 1 million people become millionaires, and each of us give some amount of that $1 trillion in wealth, we'll make a big dent in poverty. So let's wipe out poverty jointly. But that means I've got to help create 1 million millionaires. This radio show is another step in that process. Besides, it's not the poor that create the jobs, and you sure know that in 2010 and 2011, job creation is a big concern. The wealthy and middle class create those jobs. I guess I should add, if you happen to listen to this program from the archives, as many people do, then that dial-in and chat won't work. We do take some time off. But you can always reach me by email. So let me give you that now. And at the end, again, I'll give you my email. It's ron@theronald.us. I'd like to set the stage for today's show with a somewhat simple question. When's the best time to invest? And I'd like to provide you not just one answer, but actually four correct answers. And then our guest later will also give us some insights on this particular topic. You can choose which of these answers applies to you. And again, based on those insights from our guest, H.L. Quist, you'll decide when to invest. Now, the first answer is based on the first commandment of investing. My upcoming book, The Ten Commandments of Investing, you'll learn that the first commandment is buy low, sell high. Well, based on that answer, based on that commandment, the answer is simple. Buy when the price is low. Now, that always is worth following. When you buy at a high price and try to sell a low one, you will lose money. So whether it's real estate or the stock market, it's not a good time when prices are high. But when prices drop, that's the time to be buying. So like the Ten Commandments of Investing, you'll find out that it's simple, but not necessarily easy to follow. Now, the second answer is based on dollar cost averaging. Hopefully you all know that concept, but the idea is to buy small amounts regularly. I won't go through the math, but the principle is quite straightforward. And yes, if you're buying in euros or you're buying in Canadian dollars or Aussie dollars or any other currency around the world, this same principle works. It just happened to pick up the name of dollar cost averaging. You buy regularly, you buy a larger number of shares when the price is low, and you'll buy fewer shares when the price is high. That gives you gains that are far better than just buying at some typical average price. And trust me, you'll have far better gains than buying at the highest price. Now, you can improve that a little bit more by taking that regular amount and adjusting it. As the market goes down, you buy a little more, and as the market goes up, you actually buy a little bit less. That doesn't mean you stop buying because your perception is the market went up. It could keep going up for years. So make sure you invest regularly under this principle, and you'll end up with a very good return. And I guess there's a second advantage to this approach. It encourages you to save a regular amount and invest it, rather than putting off investing and waiting until you have money available. That's the usual, I'll invest later. I also suspect that this principle is what guided people like Sir John Templeton or Edward C. Johnson Jr. at Fidelity or John C. Bogle at Vanguard to launch their mutual fund companies. These funds are actually great for these kinds of regular investments of small amounts. By the way, I found they work even better if you use large amounts. Now, the third answer takes a little bit of thinking. It's based on the power of compounding. The answer then is the sooner, the better. If somebody asks me when's the best time to plant a tree, I usually tell them 20 years ago. And if you didn't do that, then now might be a good time. And compounding's that same idea. You're getting the interest, dividends, or gains on the earnings you had the prior year. Just try those calculations sometime with a 10% return or an 8% or 12%. Doesn't matter. Just try that year after year. You're going to see it grows much, much faster than just that number of years times the interest rate. Because you're accumulating earnings on the prior year's earnings. And the big lesson from this approach, again, don't wait until you have more money to invest. You're better off investing small amounts early or large amounts early. Just get started. I always use the analogy, it's like getting shade from a tree you plant 10 years from now. It doesn't help you today. The power of compounding is why I'm glad I started investing 35 years ago. Of course, I was about 2 years old, right? Now, the fourth answer takes a little bit of imagination here. Go back for a number of years. Sir John Templeton was asked this question. I recall as he paused and reflected, and I've seen him many times on TV shows or in interviews, and when he was asked this question, he paused and he answered, "When you have money." Now, that sounds like a great punchline to end this story, but it actually is pretty profound. You see, Sir John was the guy that pioneered the mutual fund business in the U.S. and later the concept of global investing, before most Americans even knew there were other financial markets. He was a real gentleman of the investing industry who invested other people's money and his own very wisely. Now, let's go back to his answer. There's a first obvious insight. If you don't have money, you can't invest it. Even if you're buying on margin, selling short, you still need some money to do this. Now, the other aspect of his response might be a little more subtle. If you do have money, you should be investing it. See, Sir John was a long-term investor, very optimistic about the prospects of the world. And again, I can picture him sitting back in the chair and saying, "There's no time in history where people were as well off as they are today." And he meant it. He was a real optimist for the future. He gave his forecast for the Dow Jones Industrials at the end of this century. He said it would be up to 1 million. Now, for those of you that follow the Dow will know that it's currently around 11,000. And coincidentally, when he made that forecast in 1999, the end of the last century, it was about the same level, just over 11,000. You see, from that point to the end of this century. It only requires 4.6% annual growth to get to that 1 million in 100 years. And that's pretty realistic. On the other hand, you'd look at it and say, well, wait a minute, if it was 11,000 back in 1999, shouldn't it be a lot higher now based on that 4.6%? Yeah. The Dow should be up over 16,500 by now. Was he overly optimistic? Well, Sir John and I would reassure you that it will get up over 16,500. It'll even exceed that 4.6% growth at various periods of time. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to tell you exactly when. Maybe our guest will. So this is a good time. Let's ask our special guest to join us and find out not only when to invest, but what to invest in now. See, H.L. Quist is an economic historian, an expert on economic cycles, and an author of 5 books and an investment newsletter. I'm a subscriber. His fourth book, The Aftermath of Greed, Get Ready for the Coming Inflationary Boom, was written back in 2008. More than 2 years ago, it seems very prophetic now. You see, now I'm hearing more and more investment gurus talking about the threat of inflation and maybe even hyperinflation. Back in 2008, nobody was talking about it. His most recent book is How to Profit from the Coming Inflationary Boom and Avoid the Next Crash. And as we've all learned over the last few years, avoiding those crashes is probably more important than being in the booms. H.L. Quist started his career in financial services. He switched to real estate brokerage and later to real estate and development. And now he's back to managing money. He's not only a financial advisor, but an athlete, an All-American. And I'd like to welcome H.L. Quist.
Ron, how are you this morning?
Just great. And I'm hoping you're doing well as well.
It's perfect timing.
That's
a key word. That's a key word.
Well, it sure is. And I'm going to ask you a lot about that timing, and I'm sure we'll have some callers as well. And as you know, I subscribe to your newsletter, and I really wonder where you come up with some of these recommended investments. I mean, some things I never even heard of before until you mentioned them, and they're up 100% this year. But before we get into that, I want to talk about three topics today: the economy, the elections, and earning money. Let's start with the economy, but I want to take you back in time, back when you and I were both a bit younger. I want to go back to the mid-60s for a second. See, I saw a recent statistic that said our poverty rate now is about as bad as it was back in the mid-60s, and that's when LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was our president, also a Democrat, and his theme was the war on poverty. I happen to remember, based on the things you've reminded me of, what the economy was like in the 70s and early 80s. And I'll call it awful. So evidently something LBJ did wasn't so great. What can our government today learn from some of his actions to not do some of those same things?
Well, it's really unusual that you ask that question, because in page 51 of How to Profit from the Coming Inflationary Boom, I go back and, you know, as a historian, I always take historical events that have real relevance today. And Lyndon Johnson's program was the Great Society. And in my book, I cite an author by the name of Charles Murray, who wrote in his book Losing Ground, and this is a quote: "In 1968, when Lyndon Johnson left office, 13% of Americans were poor, using the official definition. Over the next 12 years, our expenditures on social welfare quadrupled. And in 1980, 12 years later, the percentage of poor Americans was 13%. In other words, this whole program, the Great Society, did not accomplish what it set out to do. And what it set in motion was this 50 years of deficits and constant pyramiding. You talk about the magic of compounding, and that's
right.
If you go back and trace it, you know, the 50s were pretty steady and pretty, you know, there wasn't much growth, there was no boom and bust cycles to speak of. And, of course, from the 60s, we started robbing Social Security. This is, you know, it was guns and butter. fighting the war in Vietnam and doing all these social programs. And so what Congress did is that it started taking all of the taxes that were for Social Security and spending them currently as part of their funds and their need for funds, and depositing a note. That's when the Social Security Trust Fund disappeared.
Well, and we're lucky to still have a little bit, but I'm sure they're going to be printing a lot of money for some of the baby boomers as we retire.
Well, the reality is simply this on Social Security, and people don't like to hear it, is that benefits are going to be reduced and taxes are going to be increased, and there's going to be a means test. People like myself that are drawing Social Security because I have other income, they're simply going to look at my 1040 and they're going to say, well, you're not going to get that $20,000 a year in Social Security, but we're going to cut that in half or something like that.
Right.
So
right.
That's what's coming.
Well, and I can understand that. I remember one of the things that, looking back at that period, but trying to understand what the government might do wrong, instead of calling you, I did a little bit of research, which takes a lot more time. But the thing I found also is LBJ decided to dramatically raise the minimum wage. And in all of the checking I've done, all of the logic says anytime you raise minimum wage, that doesn't create jobs. And with poverty as high as it was and it is now, and jobless rate as high as it is, I'm just hoping they don't decide that's a good move to destroy even more jobs.
Well, what Murray points out in his book is that what this did, what the anti-poverty programs did, and of course we're right in the midst of it right now, is it removed personal responsibility and a status reward for improving one's life. That's what's behind all this, you know. It's the serfdom concept that exists in Europe today, and that's why France and all the other European countries are going through such a terrible situation.
Yep. No, I would agree. Now, we're in a little bit better shape now than we were a year or a year and a half ago, but one of my concerns I wanted to kind of share with you is that this little bit of recovery we've been seeing, and it looked a little more optimistic last year, is that banks are in reality funding at least some of that recovery. So when I obviously in the real estate industry, I'm looking at the statistics that say, you know, we've got obviously millions of people in bankruptcy, foreclosure, and a lot of them in short sales. And now the period that somebody's living rent-free in their house, because basically in their short sale they usually stop paying, that's averaging 1.4 years now. Now, that's money they would have been paying, whether it's $2,000 a month or $3,000 a month or even $1,500 a month, for 1.4 years. That's a huge amount of money that those people are either paying down debt or buying iPads or spending it on cars because they won't get credit in the future. I mean, is this a big enough number that I should be worried about that? And because it's never been talked about in any of the news, the media, and you know, my concern when I look at the banks is they're showing that as revenue because those people, in theory, are being billed for their mortgage payment. And they've put some reserves in place for the mortgage itself, but how about for some of those payments? So anyway, is this a concern that some of the uptick we've seen is just driven by what the banks are funding these people who live rent free?
Well, I think that's why everybody is surprised that consumer spending is higher than the GDP and the whole economic picture warrants. And it's been a surprise. Look at the earnings reports by all of the retailers, both at the low end and at the high end.
Higher end as well, surprise. Yeah.
But you know where most of the money is going in the banks, and of course we can talk about that in a little bit, but the banks, of course, are loaning money, or the Fed is loaning money to the banks at less than 1%, and they're requiring the banks to loan that money back to the Fed at 1% so that the Fed can take that money and buy U.S. Treasuries. That's what's going on. That's why there isn't a lot of bank financing available to small business and so forth. And now with the situation arising where Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are suing the banks to repurchase the loans, and you've got the mortgage, break in the chain of title issue coming up, the banks are holding on to the money because they know that they're going to be forced to fork over some big cash. There's an article in Barron's this weekend which says, will Bank of America stock go to $250 a share? And it takes up this issue that I just mentioned.
You're not talking about $250. You're talking about $2.50.
I'm talking about $250. I mean, they can tell by the amount of puts that have been purchased on Bank of America stock, which is currently at $11.
Right, which hasn't moved very much despite the rest of the market going up. You know, it's funny. We talked probably about 6 months ago as I was starting to put together some of my articles and papers on this TAC program, and you mentioned that, and the more I looked at it, you are 100% right on what we affectionately used to call, and well, still call, the carry trade. But we tend to think of somebody borrowing cheap, let's say back in the heydays, it was borrowing in Japan, and taking it over to Iceland, Ireland, or anywhere that they had high interest rates, and lending that money. Well, now that carry trade is taking place in Washington. I walk over to the Fed at really even 0.25% or lower the banks are getting money for, and then relending it to fund the deficit at 3.5%.
Sure, that's what the big players can do. The big players can borrow that money at these nominal rates and invest it in emerging markets. The spread is incredible.
Sure,
and that's why they
also invested just in the Treasury as well. Like I said,
and they're not investing
the deficit,
in the U.S. So. That's the key, is they're not investing it here.
Right. And I guess we could call ourselves an emerging economy in some ways, but I'm not as optimistic as I am about some others. But okay, now let's kind of take this economy, and there's a number of different what ifs, different scenarios that could play out. And you hear all of the factors and there's noise in the media, but nobody really has done a very good scenario analysis. I know that's your expertise. Tell us a little bit about what those scenarios are likely to play out over the next months and years.
Well, the Federal Reserve and Ben Bernanke has told us what the Fed's going to do. We just don't know how much and when. I think next week is critical after the elections, and the Fed is going to announce its quantitative easing, which is a euphemism, of course, for printing money.
Yep.
But I took the position, Ron, that there's three scenarios, but the first one is the QE2 plan or the reflation. I'm taking the position that is going to succeed. In other words, creating all this money out of thin air is going to result in a burst of liquidity and, of course, asset inflation. And we've seen that. We've seen it in the stock market. We've seen it in the commodity markets. We have not seen it in the real estate market, but that will happen, in my opinion. The second scenario is that the reflation plan fails and we enter into a double dip, a recession, or worst off, a depression. And the third scenario is a slog, which is what's happened in Japan for the past 20 years. When the bubble burst in 1990, the stock market, the real estate market crashed 70%, 75%, and it hasn't recovered yet.
See? Right, it just keeps kind of
they've just been slogging along. Right.
Gotcha. Bouncing along at the bottom, if you will.
Yeah, so and their federal debt is 200% of their GDP.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So they're much worse than we are. See,
They just keep printing yen, and you know what's important there is low interest rates, and they have the lowest interest rates in the world.
Sure,
and
they have for a long time.
They're paying people to borrow money.
Right.
You know, that's it's that low. Low interest rates alone, and printing yen has not improved the economy.
Right.
We're
trying the same.
That's a slog.
Okay. All right. It's funny. You touched on the QE2 meetings, and as I understand, they're going to take place right after the elections, coincidentally, I guess, to avoid that becoming somehow tied to the administration. But let me switch you to elections. I attended one of your seminars, and I don't know if you recall when we met. It was back in the October of 2008. And you had already released your book, which was written about 6 months earlier, The Aftermath of Greed. You gave this great historical backdrop. And as you walked through it, I could logically see the flow. Then you surprised the hell out of me with where you were going with it. You weren't talking about today and the president that was being disgraced wasn't indeed Bush. We were talking about Nixon. And with that, you correctly, very correctly, predicted that Obama would win. Now, we're seeing today the polls shifting. They were talking about throwing out the incumbents, and boy, I get some pretty funny emails even from the Center for Disease Control on this topic, but which obviously is made up by somebody. And they're talking about the conservatives winning, and it's either going to be the Tea Party or the Republican candidates, and they're kind of split. You sometimes have two different candidates being pushed by those two parties. What do you expect to happen? Does that splintering of those two conservative parties, or one's not officially as much a party as it is a group, but does that splintering hurt their case? And do we end up where we are? You know, what do you see happening out of this midterm but key election?
Well, whether they're rhinos or conservatives, it won't make any difference, and they could be conservative bulldog Democrats. Is that what's going to happen, in my opinion, is that all the stimulus money, extension of unemployment benefits, and funneling all this money to cities and states to continue pension payments like they're doing now, is going to stop. It's going to absolutely stop in the next Congress. That means, to me, that the sole funding source to getting money out into the marketplace is going to come from the Federal Reserve through their QE2 plan.
Okay, so that basically there will be enough of a force to stop that stimulus, what were the various TARP and other initiatives to pump money out there to fund friends and family.
That's
and
correct.
What you're saying is really going to be the Fed that's going to be printing the money, and we don't call it printing, we call it quantitative easing.
Right.
Now,
that. You know, I don't think that people realize how desperate Illinois and California, New York State, I mean, they're borrowing money to make pension payments.
Right.
You know, CalPERS, the California retirement system, is 50% underfunded. You know, and so what they've been doing is they're getting money through the Obama administration to keep the game going.
Right. Right.
And that's going to stop. That's going to stop in this new Congress.
Wow. So that does mean belt tightening and really doing some logical things as opposed to just trying to borrow.
Well, I tell you, you know, people say the Federal Reserve is not political. The Federal Reserve, Bernanke is a hired gun, just like Alan Greenspan was, and he's going to do what the politicians and the bankers want him to do.
Right,
you know,
right.
And what he's going to do is he's going to create. So, I mean, the threat really is from this action. Of course, is inflation and the potential for hyperinflation. That's, in my opinion, is what we've got to do our strategy and plan our strategy around.
Right. Okay. And while we're still on the election topic, the thing we're really talking about is the conservatives come in, is what we refer to as gridlock, where the Democrats no longer have their supermajority everywhere. Even they lost it in the House when Massachusetts brought in the Republican, so then they had to do things a little bit differently. And some of the, I guess, the positives here are that the big and those bad policy changes are likely to not go through. And as you said, the stimulus will get cut back. But it could also mean that some of the good ideas out there, if they have any, could get stalled because of that gridlock. You know the history. When you look at those gridlock situations or the lack of majority in a mixture of House, Senate, and White House, what usually happens in those scenarios, and is that good news?
Well, I think the one of the difficulties that we're looking forward to is that there's going to be just so much contentious argument over, for instance, Obamacare. There's the new Congress is going to be attempting to unwind not only that program but all of these others, and it will take the focus off of positive moves and legislation going forward. So I've told Tea Party audiences and I've told different conservative groups and so forth is be careful what you pray for, because the repercussions of it could be, you know, could even be worse.
Right.
You know,
could be worse.
Try to undo all of this progressivism and this socialism that the enormous amount of action that's been taken in the last less than 2 years.
Right. As you said earlier, during the LBJ era, that same amount of social program and helping the poor and all of that had no effect other than to create inflation and to raise the deficit. And boy, did we have inflation back in the 70s after that period.
Well, you know, and that's, Ron, this is really critical, is that, you know, when Nixon took over, you remember in 1971, he told the national, told the American people, he said, "I am now a Keynesian." And then he promptly administered wage and price controls and everything because inflation was 4%. Well, he abandoned his, you know, what was supposedly conservative roots, and he became a Keynesian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because he could not stem the tide of all of these social programs and deficit spending that Johnson had augmented.
Correct. And the deficit spending will continue. It's not a one-time event. So it's not one of these things that just because we had it now that the next administration comes in and all of a sudden it's going to drop. We know there's a lot of carry forward, especially it's tough to kill programs, as Ronald Reagan told us, that the closest thing to
That's
eternal
correct.
Life on Earth is a temporary government program, right?
Right.
Hey,
correct.
Any thoughts on the job market, and will the elections have any positive effect there or even potentially negative effect?
Well, I think that the big positive event, Ron, is sentiment. You see, what's holding back, particularly the real estate market right now, is sentiment. I speak to real estate groups all, and I spoke to a group last week. You know, I teach real estate classes.
Right.
And you know, I think in most of the classes that I'm looking at, they're zombies. They don't believe what I say about reinflation and asset inflation, how it's going to impact the real estate market. They didn't believe in 2005 when I told them that the good times were coming to an end. There's going to be a horrific crash, not only in the real estate market, but in the economy. And they were giddy with what was going on in the marketplace. You know, people, when we're at the bottom of the markets, they don't ever believe that they're going to improve. And when they're at the top, like we were in 2005 and 2006, they think it's never going to end.
Yep, you know? I agree
with
100%. Absolutely.
But the change that really needs is sentiment. And as I wrote in my last newsletter, I said that what the goal of this administration is, and Congress and the Federal Reserve, is to reinflate real estate prices.
Right.
And, you know, when we see an uptick in one neighborhood or in one state or in one city, and when there's an uptick or a home sells for more than what is anticipated, what the experts say it should, that changes sentiment.
Yep.
And, of course, that is the big drag on the markets today.
I agree with you 100%. And, obviously, you know, real estate's my core focus, but I want to make sure we cover not just real estate but all types of investing. So let's switch to earning money. Let's talk a little bit about, okay, given that backdrop, given where we are in the economy, given your scenario of inflation coming, how do we earn money in that scenario?
Well, you know, to me it was obvious that when I wrote the book in the 2008 book, How to Profit from a Coming Inflationary Boom, or in 2009, is that I knew that the TARP funds, look at Goldman Sachs, they took the TARP money, they didn't need the money. Where did that money go? It went into the stock market.
Right.
So we did get the asset reflation in both the stock market and the commodity market. You create this massive liquidity, particularly held in hands by smart money or sophisticated investors, and they're going to move the market. Look at the Dow is up from 6,500 to 11,000 basically in a little over a year. Excuse me.
Correct.
I was right on with that, and we've enjoyed fantastic games. And, of course, you know, I look for sectors that nobody's paying attention to. I mean, the rare earths, people today don't even know what rare earths, and we've got stocks up 300% and 400% this year, some of them in just 3 months. you know, and it's because I recognized what the supply demand was, what the you know, everything that we use digitally requires rare earths. The Chinese control 97% of the world's production. It was simply here was a sector that was unnoticed and unrecognized and exploited it. And we've seen those fantastic gains. Not unlike gold and the precious metals and silver and uranium now is the alternative energy of the future, and it's taking off. So that's what my expertise is, that I spot these markets before anybody else does, or, you know, a limited number of people do. And we go with that sector, it's sector rotation. And real estate will have its day also.
While we're on that, rare earth elements, again, that was something I had never heard of, and I ventured to buy a few of the recommendations we had. I just regret I didn't buy all of them immediately. But explain for our listeners what a rare earth element is. So as we all know what gold is, we know what precious metals are, and these are in some ways precious metals or precious elements. But can you give us some examples, or you know, why is it this huge demand all of a sudden?
Well, it's every digital product, every hybrid, every wind turbine requires these. There's 17, I believe, 17 different elements. These are rare elements that haven't been used in the past because there wasn't a need for them. But they are the most heat-resistant metals in the world. And, of course, every battery, every digital device, every computer, every cell phone has rare earths. And, of course, the Chinese, you know, they're great chess players. They knew this, and they cornered the market. And, of course, they're manufacturing them there, and they're putting the components together. So they announced here, you know, a month and a half ago that they were going to cut their imports, their exports, by 50 or 60%. Well, you know, there's no other supply. You know,
right.
they've tied up the supply in Australia and China, and you know, the U.S. the mines in the U.S. were all shut down, and so there's just a huge imbalance of supply and demand.
Now, some people would accuse them then of speculating and gouging or you know, kind of locking up the supply. But in some ways, what you're saying, because they're producers of these digital devices and the, you know, the biggest producer now that they've kind of taken it over from the Japanese and the Koreans, they were really hedging their supply chain.
Well, and of course they're turning out the products, you know. So they didn't want to be in a situation where they would have to go into the marketplace. So, you know, right now they're stockpiling uranium because there's over 200 nuclear plants that are going to be built in India, China, and Germany, and all over the world. And they're locking up uranium, and that price is going to take off too. And we've got in on the ground floor of that, as I did in 2000. Oh, I think it was about 2002, and some of those uranium stocks went up 1,000%, 1,500% in a period of a year, year and a half, you know.
Wow. Even smaller investments turn into big money.
And you know, this is where my expertise is, and of course, people are very reluctant. And, of course, the critical thing here in the U.S. today is that lasers and weapons desperately need these rare earth elements. And now there's real concern in the U.S. that they're not going to be able to produce the products for armaments and for these lasers and so forth, because the Chinese will withhold them, you see, from the market.
So the Department of Defense should be buying your newsletter.
Well, they've gotten the message. They've gotten the message. I think
late,
one of my recommendations is a candidate to be bought out by the U.S. government to preserve these resources. Yeah.
Now, with lithium, which is going to be used in a lot of the future batteries, or at least we think it is it? It's probably not a metal in that list of 17. But is that another example of where, you know, the demand for something that's in limited supply could boom?
Well, yeah, the U.S. shut down all of its battery manufacturers that were using the old technology. And,
right,
of course, the Chinese, they picked up on that. And lithium was just kind of, people knew where the lithium was. Recently, they found them in these brine lakes. You know, that's why I recommended that stock, that Solaris, that had those five brine lakes in South America. And it was bought out by the largest lithium producer in the world, Talison, out of Australia. And, of course, our shareholders enjoyed a nice pop with most of those stocks that I've outlined are potential candidates for a buyout. And that's where you get your big play, you know.
Sure, but a 50% growth is nothing like a 100 or 200 that you've seen before the buyout, so that's not bad. Another prediction you made, now, it turned out to be, as many of your predictions, not only correct, but a little bit early, or other events kind of take place in between, and people lose heart. I mean, you know, if you make a prediction, for example, the bond bubble. Some of the people that heard that, I reacted immediately. That was early in our days of getting to know each other. So I immediately, more or less, dumped all my bonds pretty quickly. Had I kind of said, all right, HL's ahead of the curve. He sees these things sometimes years ahead of it happening. You're absolutely correct on the event. And now, again, everybody's talking about it. Article on, CNN Money or something like that, again, on, you know, people are now moving out of the treasury bills into stocks, and that could mean, you know, good news for the stock prices, and bonds will start dropping. So you're a little bit early. Is this a time to be out of bonds for the most part?
Well, we know that Bernanke's objective is, through quantitative easing, is to keep interest rates low. And the Fed history is that they keep them low too long, just as they did in the real estate boom and from 2002 to 2006. It's problematical. Whether they can keep these rates low, printing all this money. But at some point in time, if the reflation plan works, the bond bubble is going to be probably the biggest. It's going to be as big as the real estate bubble because there is so much money, and these people, these sophisticated investors, they want to lock down those 30% and 40% gains that they've had in bonds, and then reverse their position and go short. And I got in early and I saw that rates were going lower, and I covered my bond positions and got out, took a small loss. And we're just waiting for the appropriate time to back shorting those treasuries again.
Okay, and Bill, it was funny, there's Bill Gross, I guess about a month or two ago, who's the bond guru at PIMCO there, and he's evidently started up a stock fund, so I guess he has some place to move his bond holdings. But when that starts happening, no matter how much money you print, it's going to be hard to keep interest rates low when the demand starts dropping. You know, a big investor like PIMCO can really swing those bond returns.
And they've reduced their U.S. Treasury holdings by 30%. Here's a fund that has $250 billion in it, the PIMCO Total Return Fund.
That's just one of those funds, yeah.
Yeah, and that's just, well, that's the biggest bond fund. But
sure,
they reduced their exposure to it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. All right. Now, does that mean we're returning now to the predictions you had in your two books, both The Aftermath of Greed, which obviously was a great title, and at that time everybody started to recognize we had just been through greed, and Profit. Again, it seems like you're a little bit early, that some of these inflationary scenarios were kind of on the horizon, but you were reading the tea leaves way before anybody even noticed that they were out there. Now we're hearing more about that, so is this the time that people should be reading both those books?
I think so, yeah. And you know, the reason why we didn't get the inflationary boom sooner is because we didn't know, you and I and many, many other people that are smarter than us, could not assess how deep the damage was done in the real estate mortgage market. We just, what really happened there, Ron, is that people like Goldman Sachs created these synthetic mortgages. In other words, it had no underlying asset, no mortgage, no real estate, no borrower, and they were selling those all around the world. And of course, when the market broke, these were absolutely worthless. And, Michael Lewis covered that in his book, The Great Short. I mean, it's but in 2008 and even 2009, we didn't know that existed. And of course, it has had such an impact because it affected so many people. The dot-com bubble burst of 2000, only 25% of the people in this country had money in the equity markets.
Right.
So, and they hadn't borrowed money. They weren't underwater. They may have taken a loss, but they weren't underwater. So, yeah, I was early to the game, but it paid off because we had asset inflation starting in March of 2009 in the equity market and the commodity markets.
Sure. No, I mean, it's still been a very good period. That's not a criticism. I just, in many cases, I'm finding that you tend to be ahead of the curve. It takes
a when you get to the party early, Ron, though, you know, I learned that when I was in the eighth grade, is that the pretty girls were still available. If you got to the party early, there weren't any pretty girls left, and you went home, you walked home alone.
That's right. Or that you have to drink a lot, and then they all start looking good, right? I won't go there. You know, for 2 years, you were very, very optimistic, and obviously a lot of these things very correct. In May this year, you said emphatically in your newsletter and a special email that came out, sell.
Mm-hmm.
Flat out sell. Don't ask questions, just start selling. Then somewhere in August, you hinted at a pre-election rally, and in your September newsletter, you said close your short positions and do some buying back to some of those positions that you sold off. But does that mean you're optimistic, or were you just correctly anticipating this pre-election rally that seems to be continuing? Now, I'm assuming it's continuing today just because you're on the, you'll be on the show and people will hear about where things are going. But and it could reverse tomorrow. But you know, where are you? Are you optimistic?
Well, the only thing I recommended selling in May was the U.S. equity positions because of the flash crash and what was going on in Greece and so forth. And they had to deal with that potential meltdown coming on the heels of the one we'd just been through. So I'm still holding off on U.S. equities, and I have because I'm waiting to see the resolution of the election and the QE2 program. And in all probability, I will come out and recommend a repurchase of those U.S. equities. But we certainly have made up the total portfolio is up 25% year-to-date, where the S&P is up a little over 5%. So we've done very well.
Yeah, no, I recognize that. And again, I wish I had the time to immediately get, buy orders on each of your recommendations. I don't always do that. By the time I do a little bit of thinking, scratching my head and reading the rest of the email, I'm a little bit late on some of these, or I kind of hedge my bet and do some of them. But nonetheless, it's been a big, big positive factor. Now, you touched on one thing that's important to me, real estate. It will have its day. Any thoughts of where, when that's likely to happen? It's clearly under an inflationary scenario. Commodities and real estate do well, and as you taught me, cash does awful and bonds do worse than stocks. It depends. So then that's one of the reasons I asked you where you are in that optimism. But how about real estate? When do you think its day will come?
Well, I think that we've got to measure the effects of the quantitative easing. I mean, we know the goal of the Fed. The real estate market could take this whole economy down. And so they're going to address that. There's going to be plans that, Treasury postponed plans for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac until January in the new Congress. I think there's some program coming to maybe purchase mortgages, maybe a residential trust corporation like we had the RTC back in 1990, something like that. Because here's what the reflation plan is intended to do. It's intended to reflate these hard assets. Debt is a constant. The debt's going to remain the same. The only solution to this real problem that they recognize now is to make the real estate asset inflate in value.
Correct.
Because that will have a tremendous psychological impact in the marketplace to see values rising rather than continue to fall.
Correct. You know, and then again, it's back to some of that sentiment. Once people see it's happening, it tends to bring in the followers.
Well, just think of the money that'll flow out of the bond market into real estate if values start to increase. Huge.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way. I guess I tend to think of stocks versus real estate, but you're absolutely right in terms of cash flow and a ongoing investment and asset backed safer than equities. Real estate tends to do just that, especially on the debt side. Before we forget, as later I'll get wrapped up here in a few minutes, why don't you tell our listeners how to get a hold of you, how to get your newsletter, and to follow your predictions.
Well, the easiest way, I've got a blog. I use a blog as my home site,
right?
And the probably the best way to find me is HL Quist, Quist, or my personal email is hlquist@cox.net. But if people just go to Google HL Quist, it'll lead them and it'll link them to my blog site. Because the blog site address is too long for people to write down.
Well, it is fairly long. It's the aftermath of greed, right? And
the aftermath of greed -updates .blogspot,
right?
BLOGSPOT .com.
But you are right with Google or if you want to was it Bing or Blig or whatever these.
Bing,
correct. And I heard that stands for because it's not Google.
That's pretty good. That's what I had heard.
That's where the name came from, because it's not Google.
Yeah.
We got a couple minutes left. Are there some topics we didn't cover that you think would be important for our listeners to be aware of? And, my questions aren't always covering the whole the whole world and all of the aspects. I obviously have some interests in what I should be doing today and tomorrow and the next year in investments. But are there some topics we might have missed that you think are important to get across?
Well, when people go to my blog site, they can preview my newsletter. It doesn't have the stock recommendations, but there's just a wealth of information there that's free. The newsletter is $99 a year, and
correct.
The special I'll make available to your listeners are they'll get the two books free if they sign up for the newsletter. So that's a $40 value that won't cost them anything. And but they need to take advantage of that. They can't do it through my publisher.
Sure.
Also, I'm on all the iPads and all the Apple things, so they can find the aftermath of greed there. I think it's $6 or $7. But you can get the two free books, hard copies from me. And all you have to do is go to email me at hlquist@cox.net.
Correct. Or if they email me, I'll forward the information.
Yeah.
That's
a great offer. You.
Boy. That is – I've got both those books. I didn't pick up The Secret yet, although I think our folks will want to get that, especially in the boomer era. We'll really appreciate that book as well. But no, that's a great offer. I am a subscriber, as I mentioned, and have both of your books. I've read portions of it from time to time, and I need to go back and now take it really to heart, because as I'm starting to sense you're right on, and those predictions in April of 2008 are just about to happen. Exactly.
Well, every boom, Ron, gets higher, and every bust goes lower. And every time we have a bust, it's a short-term fix to solve the problem, which sets us up for a longer-term consequence, and that's what the history tells us. Everything, I start from 74 all through these 12 or 13 boom and bust cycles. So I think the background and the education everybody says the history is fantastic, because everybody remembers where they were when they happened.
Oh boy, I did.
And how it happened.
When you ran through that Nixon and Carter scenario, I just had goosebumps go up my back as I kind of recollected some of those things. Then you brought us kind of in one fell swoop into 2008 and the elections then. And it was just pretty obvious from your story that was going to happen. That's when I really started to appreciate that history, and I agree. But, what that means is this next boom could be absolutely gigantic. The bad news is the crash that you say will likely follow and
the
will
key
follow.
The key is getting in. Blood in the real estate market, blood is in the streets. That's what Baron von Rothschild said, is that's the time to buy when there's blood in the streets. But we should be buying real estate today with an exit strategy, depending upon how this inflation manifests itself. If we get into hyperinflation, just remember, you can up your rents on your houses or your commercial property on a monthly basis.
Right, right.
So
yep.
Owning...
No, you do have to put those in. Don't do a three-year rental lease right now without some inflation clauses in there. You could
yeah,
have
well, in the profit book, I have an entire chapter devoted to hyperinflation and how you prepare for it. Because if you don't prepare for it before it happens, it'll be too late.
Right, right. It is tough. And I happen to live through some of that over in Eastern Europe.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've talked about Poland and, you know, the results there.
Exactly. So that was interesting times, but we definitely weren't prepared. And I went over in the middle of that. Now everything worked out well, and we had a lot of fun. And you know, it's much easier to become a billionaire and hyperinflationary than it is you know, today. But those billions don't buy as much. That's for sure.
Well, but the exit strategy is critical. It is critical. And I believe I can tell everybody when to get out of Dodge.
Well, that's going to be important, and that's you know, one of the reasons that you know, I like your newsletter. One is I don't always remember to go to the blog to look up, you know, what's the newest, especially when you're busy with alligators chomping at various parts of your body. But at the same time, with that coming in, I grab it immediately, and as soon as I have a little bit of time, I'll read it page by page and go through the recommendations. So your newsletter is great. Appreciate that. Well, HL, it has been great having you join us. And we hope, I sure hope, you'll be willing to meet with us again.
Certainly.
I'm sure our listeners
thank
will be
you. I hope our listeners have benefited from our time together.
You bet. And the good news is they'll have a chance to go back to the archive. If they didn't take notes or if they want to, if they missed a piece of it, or if they want to recommend to friends.
Yeah.
I always learn a lot from you and have profited from your predictions. This year has been unusually, maybe the unusual spread from the normal market, but you know, I'm always glad to hear some of your recommendations and talk to you you know, firsthand.
And well, thanks again. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, and you know what's important, there's sometimes you predict things I don't want to hear, but I know I need to know them. so even predictions I don't want to hear are worth knowing, because that prepares me better. Well,
yeah.
Here's a couple housekeeping chores before we close here. As I mentioned, this show will be archived on the same Boomer and Bay page you're on. On the left side, there's an on-demand section. Or if in there, or quite frankly in Google, you type in Wealth DNA, you'll find it. If you do want to contact me, especially after listening to one of the archives, our email is ron@theronald.us, ron@theronald.us. And I can assure you, if you want to get on our list for announcements, you won't be getting any spam. You'll just hear it about the events. Speaking of events, I don't have the final date yet, but we will have another Learn to Earn a Higher Return seminar in the Phoenix area. That will be in November. With the Thanksgiving holiday, we're juggling a little bit of exactly when that'll be. But again, just send me an email. I'll send you the timing, and we'll even furnish breakfast. No charge to the event. The next Wealth DNA radio show, same place, fourth Monday at 8 o'clock, November 22nd. For those of you not in Arizona, not in the rest of the world, Arizona doesn't change our clocks. So Pacific time, it'll be 7 in the morning. East Coast will be 10 in the morning. And Continental Europe will be 1600. Our special guests, that show will be Tom Legren and T.J. Legren, the authors of Success or Failure? The choice is yours. We'll be focusing on ways to improve your DNA. And those guys have done a great job with this book. They're doing some seminars around that topic. And when they hand you a mirror and say your success is dependent on the person you see in the mirror, it's pretty dramatic way to get you into that topic. So we'll have them do that. We'll have them pass the mirror around here on this radio show. Recall that Wealth DNA is an acronym. It's the three big obstacles to becoming wealthy. Those obstacles hold back some 95% to 99% of the population from becoming wealthy. Those three obstacles, the first is desire. Hopefully, as listeners, your desire is stronger than the subconscious programming you got early in your life. All those things about the filthy rich, the stinking rich, who wants to be filthy and stinking. But desire. The second obstacle is knowledge. or some people spell it knowledge. And you just got a big dose of knowledge on the economy, the upcoming elections, and earning money now and in the future. Action? That's the third obstacle. That part is up to you. Have a great week, and be sure to vote. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Wealth DNA with the Ronald, Ron Naraki. Wealth DNA is a Boomer and the Babe Enterprises radio production. Contact them at boomerandthebabe.com.